Hi, everyone. Welcome to ArcQM Plus Live number 77. Get ahead of the crisis, how your quality system can prevent negative impacts on customers, patients, and reputation. I'm marketing principal at ArcQM Plus, Stephen Bernacki, and I'm going to start today by sharing a bit about ArcQM Plus and formally introducing today's panelists. After that, we'll have a brief presentation that'll set the stage for the discussion that will take the remainder of our time. If you have questions today, we hope you'll take advantage of the chance to ask them. You can do that directly in the chat. If you were here last month, we had some technical challenges with the platform, but we listened to your feedback. We're very happy to say we've implemented a new platform this month. So again, please ask your questions in the chat. And if you see a question that someone else has asked that's interesting to you, and you hope that we would answer, please feel free to interact with that so we know. So ArcQM Plus is a global medtech service provider focused on accelerating compliance and market success. Through our unparalleled expertise and industry knowledge, we deliver specialized solutions and expedite the journey along the full product lifecycle for med device and IVD companies from concept to commercialization and continuing through post-market. You can learn a lot more about us at the same place you registered for the event today at arcqmplus.com. And now on to today's panelists, and we're going to start with our very special guest, Stephen Needleman, who serves as lead quality systems and compliance consultant to the FDA and life sciences practice at King & Spalding. Stephen specializes in regulatory enforcement and policy matters involving industries regulated by the FDA. He provides strategic advice, insight, and guidance to the medical device, pharmaceutical, biologics, and food industries to ensure compliance with the requirements of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Stephen has formerly served as the Deputy Commissioner of the Office of Regulatory Affairs at the FDA. Next up is Scott Edwards, Director at ArcQM Plus. Scott is a strategic business leader with 35 years of experience in the medical device industry. He brings significant experience in driving and leading product development, design transfer to manufacturing, risk management, CAPA, complaint handling, field actions, regulatory inspection strategy, and remediation activities of all types. Scott is passionate about doing the job right and enabling clients to move forward with efficient, proactive, and sustainable processes. Finally, he brings practical solutions coupled with his years of experience to ensure the right size solution is brought to everything that he does. Our third panelist today is Richard Freeman, Director of the Global Audit Practice at ArcQM Plus. Richard has over 30 years experience working in the medical device industry. He spent 9 years with the British Standards Institute supporting the Saudi Food and Drug Authority in implementing their first set of medical device regulation. He has spent more than 2 decades as head of research and development, designing and developing novel medical devices, including drug device combinations. Richard is passionate about continuous improvement and supporting clients in moving, as he says, from good to better to best. It's a perfect motto. Our final panelist today is Steve Keverline, who's managing director within ArcQM Plus's regulatory and quality consulting services business unit. Steve has over 30 years of device experience, including 12 working as a consultant at ArcQM Plus with more than 100 different companies. His background is in new product development, quality and manufacturing engineering, covering a broad array of products, and he has significant experience in regulatory affairs. He's led numerous clients through resolving FDA 483, warning letter, and notified body findings, and has extensive experience developing quality systems and implementing balanced solutions to fit the needs of the organization while ensuring regulatory compliance. Lastly, our moderator today, and she has a ton of experience herself, by the way, is Vice President of Business Development, Teresa Miles. Teresa has 30 years of experience working in healthcare, 12 and a half spent with ArcQM Plus. So with all of that said, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Keverline to begin our short presentation. Steve and everyone, you should be able to see the slide right now. And you can go ahead, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, we thought it would be good to start this session by doing a little grounding and in specific touching on what I'll call an abbreviated evolution of the FDA quality system regulation for medical devices. The idea was really to try to set the stage for the why behind the regulations and the intent, right, to prevent a crisis. During the 1960s, a study was conducted on adverse effects associated with medical devices at the time. And the conclusion of the study recommended an approach of classifying medical devices based on risk. In 1970s, it was determined that intrauterine devices released in the US market had injured at least 900,000 women. This further highlighted the need to take action and provide more regulatory oversight of medical devices. As seen in this picture here, in May of 1976, Title 21 amendments were signed into law by Gerald Ford, our 38th president of the US. This amended the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to provide for the safety and effectiveness of medical devices. The amendment included establishing a series of classifications for medical devices based on the risk posed to the consumer or user. High-risk devices must undergo FDA pre-market approval to determine whether they provide reasonable assurance of safety and effectiveness. Moderate-risk devices need to go through pre-market review to determine if they are substantially equivalent to pre-amended devices. And all devices are subject to general controls at a minimum. This also included the requirements of establishment, registration, and device listing. So in 1978, 21 CFR 820 was codified as the current Good Manufacturing Practice Final Rule, which also established medical device reporting and responsibility for field corrections and removals. This next slide here talks about, really since the 1978 Final Rule, FDA evaluated device recalls that had occurred from October 1983 through September 1989, and found that approximately 45% of quality problems were attributed to errors or deficiencies that were designed into particular devices and may have been prevented by adequate design controls. This led to the realization that the CGMPs do not fully address product design and purchasing controls. And while you can test product into compliance, the quality system needs to take a more holistic approach. Compliance does not necessarily ensure quality of processes or products. Quality done right will result in compliance. Your organization must have both to succeed. This resulted in revision to the QSR in 1996. And where are we today? On the right-hand side, on February 2nd of 2024, the FDA published a final rule to amend the device CGMP requirements of the QSR and harmonize them with the internationally accepted ISO 13485 standard. This is now known as the Quality Management System Regulation, QMSR, and the QMSR became effective on February 2nd, 2026. Okay. I will let Steve Meadleman speak to potential consequences of not following these regulations.
Thanks, Steve. As you know, FDA conducts thousands of medical device inspections both domestically and overseas every year, with the exception probably the COVID years. Your goal is always obviously to have zero inspectional outcomes, that your inspection is classified as NAI, you have no observations, and you're operating in full compliance with all of FDA's requirements, especially quality system related. There are a lot of potential consequences of inspectional outcomes, and it depends where you sit as far as whether or not you're having your initial 483 first time, perhaps an initial inspection at your site, or you've had a history of repeated 483s or repeated inspections where problems have been found. If you have an initial inspection and there were some concerns that were raised by FDA, but they didn't necessarily raise to the level of concern about public health or significance, you may receive an untitled letter from the agency telling you that they reviewed your response to the 483, which, quite frankly, you need to understand. A response is expected within 15 days, but there's no legal requirement to submit that response. That you may receive this untitled letter. It may or may not have a time-bound deadline for responding. If it's significant enough, you may receive a warning letter, which indicates that failure to correct the observations may result in more significant actions, such as seizure, injunction, or prosecution. If you're an outside the United States firm, it could result in your product being put on import detention, stopping it from further importation into the United States. They may invite you to a regulatory meeting, or in the case of some inspectional observations, they may identify issues to you that you might not have been aware of, or you were festering on decisions, and it could result in a product recall that you may need to undertake under Part 806. The more significant outcomes are on follow-up inspections where FDA has previously advised you of concerns and they see repeat findings that are of concern. And those may result in a warning letter, again, not a final agency action, but may failure to comply with the outcome could result in more significant actions. That warning letter could be corporate-wide if they see a culture of quality that is pervasive throughout many of your sites, and they see a pattern of noncompliance, they may decide to issue a corporate-wide warning letter. In the medical device land, as they have a recidivist warning letter unique to devices, which is a time-bound response generally of a year to come into compliance with a certification by outside experts of achieving compliance. Again, import detention is an option for the firm if it's an outside United States inspection. The same regulatory meeting where they invite you in to discuss your issues, generally inviting top management of your firm to attend those. They can impose a seizure of your product. It is rarely used today in medical devices, but they do use injunctions which result in negotiation of consent decrees that basically shuts you down until you come into compliance. We generally can negotiate carve-outs for medically necessary products. And those injunctions have been imposed corporate-wide in several instances in the past as well. And they can impose civil money penalties. And of course, for the really slow learners, there's prosecution. And those prosecutions lately have been falling under False Claims Act type prosecutions. Keep in mind, besides the FDA inspectional observations, these all can result in whistleblower complaints to the agency that make the agency aware of things going on at your firm that you're not upfront or taking care of appropriately. And of course, litigation, which is costly, it affects product loyalty, and it certainly affects your bottom line. So these inspectional observations can be quite consequential. I'm going to turn it over to Richard for the next, there we go. So Scott is going to talk about FDA 483 citation data.
Great, thank you, Stephen. Yeah, I wanted to provide you a list here. This is looking at a summary of the last 5 years of 483 observations. If you've been part of an FDA inspection, it probably comes as no surprise, the list that you're seeing, and especially no surprise that inadequate CAPA and complaint procedures top that list. These are generally the primary areas that an FDA inspector will start looking at to see if you're monitoring for product complaints and if you're taking action against those. And so these areas are the primary triggers to identify quality and safety issues of your product. So it's foregone conclusion that this is where they're going to look first. You want to make sure that you're properly identifying, escalating, discussing, and acting on any of these issues that you identify through your inputs. If you're not doing that, then you're actually doing your customers a disservice because you're not allowing the systems to and to mitigate those problems early on. Rather, you're allowing those problems to grow, which can have catastrophic results, not only for your users and customers, but also for your business, bottom line, and your reputation. So how do you know if these processes are working? Certainly can look at internal audits, dive into the details, but that may only give you part of the picture from a compliance standpoint. You also have to look at the decisions that are being made around and within these processes based on the data that you're gleaning from these processes. You also monitor the different metrics that are available that these processes provide through management review and other review activities where you can get a true picture of what's going on with your products, with its effectiveness and safety. Now, if you identify processes that aren't working, what can you do about it? How can you stay ahead of the crisis? And the answer there is really to remediate those processes. So I'll speak briefly about the remediation activities. Remediation is focusing on those underlying causes rather than the symptoms. So an example of that would be you really want to focus on a sustainable and conforming kappa system rather than just going in and remediating individual kappas. Although if you remediate your kappa system, you most likely will have to go in and remediate individual kappas as a result of that. But really taking a systems approach to resolving chronic quality quality system and GMP non-conformances will really result in a comprehensive, sustainable quality system that does provide assurance of high quality products with the additional benefit of assuring regulatory compliance. Remediation is really the result of the cause. So understanding the cause and being able to address it on a systemic level is going to be key. Now, it's also important to understand what remediation is not. So remediation is not ad hoc consulting, bringing a consultant in to ask about a specific area. It's also not a QMS gap analysis, although a gap analysis can bring you the initial indications of issues, and it can lead to remediation in the long term. Just doing a gap analysis isn't remediation enough. Auditing is another tool, as previously mentioned, although it can be a function of remediation, and it can also be available on the back end to confirm the effectiveness of a remediation activity. Regular updates to clinical support documents, such as CER, PMCFs, and the like, they're not really remediation because those are ongoing activities that you should be doing as part of your normal process anyway. But they are also indicators that provide data into your system. But going in and doing those regular updates is not really a remediation. And finally, regulatory submissions, they're not really remediation in and of itself. It should be as a result of your ongoing quality system activities. Risk management activities that identify changes, identify changes to your 510K or notified body submission. So those are activities, obviously, that go on, but it's not really part of your remediation. So why am I focusing so much on remediation? Because this whole presentation is around staying ahead of the crisis. So if you can take a proactive approach and keep your systems updated, stay in compliance, but also make sure that the decisions that are being made throughout those processes are in your customer's best interest, then the fallout from that will be in your business best interest, not only to the bottom line, but to your company's reputation as well. So just some factors to consider when doing remediation activities. Company culture. It's extremely important to make sure that you have alignment of the company's organization to a common vision as to what you're trying to accomplish. You want to make sure that the remediation effort not only meets the regulatory requirements, but also meets the business strategy. Where do you think and What is the image that you're bringing forth? Communications is a second key, and that's really ensuring that you're providing the necessary attention across the organization, not just in the silo that's being remediated, but across the organization, that you can effectively convey key ideas and have support of ongoing development of the remediation effort. Like I say to a lot of my clients, you get into a remediation, you turn over a rock, you find 10 more rocks. So having that open communication allows you to have that collaborative effort, which is the third success factor. And that's really ensuring that that you have a culture that promotes groups of people getting together to constructively talk about issues, explore ideas, find efficient and effective and compliant solutions. So with that, I will turn things over to Richard, who will talk a little bit more about auditing.
Great. Thank you very much, Scott. Well, thank you for that. Obviously, for conducting audits, the first thing you really require is to have auditors with the relevant expertise. So you're looking for people who actually have a deep understanding of both the quality systems and the regulations that you're conducting the audit against. From our perspective, there is a cost saving to be had by using an external service like RQM Plus to conduct these audits. The cost to the organization whilst you're having members of staff conduct internal audits is a challenge. It's typically difficult to get to make sure that they're up to speed to the regulations, and also finding the time available to conduct the audits. So we talk about that cost saving, having someone come in who is an expert and can have conduct the audit in an efficient and effective way. So that's the cost saving. The time saving itself is related to the amount of resource involved in just organizing an audit, having the right people available at the right time, having everybody lined up so that the audit occurs effectively. Typically, you're also auditing maybe not just your site, but other sites as well. So getting those involved so that the whole thing is a smooth, time-efficient process. The other challenge we face, or the clients face, is the independence of the auditor. It is difficult, and I know this from talking with our clients, particularly someone who has to tell the CEO of the organization some difficult news. And having that ability to speak truth to power is a challenge and can be challenging. So taking somebody from outside to bring in that expertise and knowledge and gravitas to give that information to the members, senior members of staff. And finally, the fifth point there is compliance. The regulations and standards do change. Keeping up to speed with those on a regular basis takes time and energy and effort. And so having a team of experts who are committed to maintaining their compliance and knowledge is a very powerful tool to have in your toolbox. So that's it. Teresa, over to you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Fantastic foundation. I love a good history lesson. There will be a quiz later. So everyone, I hope you were paying attention to exactly the number of Gerald Ford in their present line. So there'll be a quiz. We are here today because we know that there's been a significant trend in the industry around device recall, specifically class ones. And I wanted to start today talking about the fact, obviously, no one wants to have a recall. No one wants to have a compliance issue. Most organizations don't have a rainy day fund, let's face it. And these compliance risks and compliance issues are not inexpensive. Can the panel go ahead and get us started today talking about this, these nuance, this the experiences the companies are facing, increased concern around the volume of these recalls? I really just want to jump into this topic right away. And I think, Richard, actually, I'm going to go back to you if that's okay. Can you get us started off? Thank you.
Yeah, I would start with something we were talking about earlier, which was the quality culture within an organization. And that's critical. My team of auditors, they constantly have what I describe as a great audit. A great audit is where the site is ready for the audit. They welcome the auditor. It's a collaboration. A great audit doesn't necessarily mean there are no findings, that the findings are accepted and they look at it and they go, they look at it as a learning opportunity. It's a collaboration between the auditor and the site to try and help them improve. So it's that mindset of continuous improvement. Those are the great audits. And the opposite side is the obviously the more challenging ones. So.
No, of course, true. I want to ask the rest of the panel too. I mean, what you're saying, Richard, is so true. It's a culture. And you know, there are companies out there that unfortunately don't necessarily embrace the culture. And they oftentimes don't embrace the culture due to the cost. We know that there's a cost to poor quality. We also know doing things right can be costly as well, right? Stephen Needleman or Steve Caroline, do you have anything else to add in terms of just best practices? And how do we help someone who's joined us today really help bring that culture and that communication into their organization?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. What we see is we assist a lot of clients with situations that they don't even realize there is a recall going on. Or they should have reported it as a recall under Part 806 They think just retrieving devices is nothing. So they have silent recalls, what they term silent recalls, you know, product that, well, we just have changed software. It was no big deal. Or we did it out in the field. We didn't retrieve anything. They don't recognize the difference between a recall and a correction based upon the regulations. They don't understand necessarily that, you know, it's really reducing any product that reduces a risk to health requires a Part 806 report to the agency, which FDA has come out with a simple form to follow on the website. And they've come out with FAQs for those that have some that are confused by any of it. They're trying to simplify the process as much as possible so that the industry reduces the number of questions and pushbacks from the agency. But yeah, we see all sorts of situations where firms don't recognize that if they're retrieving products because of complaints, it's a reportable event. It's not just product improvement. We see a lot of these kind of scenarios all the time and assist firms with getting it right and trying to educate them as to what is the appropriate requirements for compliance.
Steve, did you want to add too?
Yeah, I'll add just, you know, Steve Needleman has just seen so much. And I think this might resonate too with this decision to recall or not recall, right? So it needs to be done in a timely manner. And often you see, you know, this decision dragging on for weeks or months or open-ended. You know, recall decisions, I think, you know, from best practices, from what I've seen, you know, it is establishing that safety review board, putting that review board in place and making it just the normal process, right? So a consistent manner to be able to assess when situations occur. And that safety review board should really be this cross-functional team, ideally including senior management, but more importantly, well, as equally important, strong clinical representation. So you need to have clinical representation that understands the product, that understands the use case, the clinical risks. It becomes really important. So you know, along with that becomes the risk analysis. Don't be afraid to update your risk analysis. You know, sometimes new product development, you make assumptions. A lot of times we'll see where hazards are missed and they're not updated or maybe hazard situations aren't reflective of real world. Don't be afraid to update that. Again, that's the living, breathing system that makes this process more efficient, more effective. And then just kind of last, I guess I would say, recommendations. Again, so you're ready, so you can make the decisions when you need to. Do mock recalls. So if you should have procedures in place, you need to make sure that you're consistently doing that every time. Build in a mock recall process. Test your traceability. Test your ability to move quickly and really get the data, the information that you need to make the right decisions and act quickly. So these are processes that you should have procedures in place. But test them because these are procedures that you may not use all the time. By going through the motions, everybody's going to be more confident and comfortable in how to execute this.
Yeah, to Steve's point, it's important that health hazard evaluation process or that recall procedure, that there is a big D associated with it, because sometimes there's a lot of paralysis by analysis. And if some of these committees are too large, you get too many people on it, there are too many thoughts, too many inputs, and you're constantly reevaluating, keeping going, coming back to the table. You need to have somebody who is responsible for that decision, and that decision has to stand. And at the end of the day, those decisions have to be made quickly. I've been at firms where literally they come back to that health hazard evaluation committee or safety committee, whatever it's called, 7, 8, 9 times because people object to one word or two. And then the next one, two other words are objected to. You need somebody, you need to have a concise committee with the right players, the right corporate management there. And there needs to be somebody very clearly designated as the decision maker. And at the end of the day, that decision needs to be made promptly and it needs to be addressed quickly because this can affect public health.
Stephen, from your extensive experience, do you suggest that organizations err on the side of conservative in terms of these decisions? Is it better that you, yes, a recall has money associated with it, but is it better to move towards a more significant recall effort than downplaying it and maybe not doing enough from a, just from a regulatory perspective and an FDA perspective?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's only natural for firms to be biased that their products are great. And for the most part, products, the industry is doing great. They've innovated, they're terrifically innovative, they're very entrepreneurial. But at the end of the day, it's about patient risk. And what's the significance of that patient risk? What's the frequency of that patient risk? There have been class one recalls with one event. If it's that catastrophic event that you don't want to repeat, you need to recall that device. You don't want, for example, an X-ray machine falling on you and crushing somebody. You don't want that to happen again after it's happened the first time. And there are other situations where, you know, we think this is not significant enough. We can address it during next generation design. But again, be conservative on the side of patient risk. That's what it always comes down to. And to Steve's point, you need to have the right clinical representation at these committees. There are a lot of health hazard evaluation committees that have absolutely no clinical input into them. They have engineers, which are great. They have people that are knowledgeable about the product, but they don't look at the clinical aspects. And some firms we find also when they search their database, because they should be continually trending and monitoring complaint data, they only look for keywords that they want. We had a client recently that they had a situation in front of them. They didn't believe it was a recall scenario. They went into a meeting with FDA, and FDA wanted to know what they were doing about these three or four serious injury complaints. They had no idea we're even there because they didn't search the right keywords. So keywords are great, but they're not suitable for everything that you really should be looking at. So, you know, to Steve's point, you really should be challenging your system. Make sure you have the right people on the health hazard evaluation committee and act appropriately when the situation arises.
No, that's fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about the systems. Anyone that knows me personally knows I love Kappa. My previous life was Kappa and audits. I was curious, actually, if anyone wouldn't mind putting in the chat if they've used the mock audit activities at all at their organization and if it was positive. I've personally seen it be an extremely positive tool for our client base to prepare your staff. I myself was on the flip side of being the audited person, the auditee, and having done any sort of preparatory work and running through the just back room, front room, that whole interaction, the communication, the trying to find documents, all of that really helped us prepare. And I was curious, if you don't mind putting in the chat, if you've used that technique and if it's worked for you. Obviously, if you've not used it, want to try it, please give us a call, shameless plug. But let's talk about Kappa and complaint handling. And I'm going to make another joke and you can roll your eyes. I read a book a long time ago and the title was Complaints Are a Gift. And I know not everybody may think that way, but I do. I feel as though Kappa and complaints in particular, it's obvious they are the top two observations of 43s. Can we talk a little bit about that? And I'm actually going to get Scott involved in the conversation. Can you elaborate on why those two things might actually be the two top observations?
Sure, Teresa, I'd be happy to. From a risk management standpoint, complaint handling is really your first indicator. Once you've launched a product, your complaint handling process is what's looking for, is there anything that you haven't considered? You know, during the design process, you go through rigorous FMEA activities where you try to identify every single scenario that can happen. And it isn't until you get your products out in the field that new issues pop up, things that you didn't consider or use cases that you didn't consider. So having an effective complaint handling system allows you visibility into what's really going on in the real world. It also identifies, you know, those risks that you may not have considered before. So ensuring that that you have a good complaint handling system that brings that information in, that you're monitoring those trends, you're reviewing those trends on a regular basis, and then based on those trends, elevating to CAPA, where you're actually diving into those details, understanding why is that trend taking place, what is the root cause behind that, what do we need to do to prevent that from reoccurring, or what do we need, what corrections do we need to take in the field, or with the product or with the design in order to correct those moving forward. So it's a very, those two pieces are a very integral part of your total risk management system, and the output of those activities actually feed back in to your risk management system, where you should be regularly updating your risk management documents and ensuring that you're constantly looking for issues and understanding the safety and the effectiveness of your products. That's the reason why FDA typically starts with those two areas, because either the company is collecting and they're acting on it, and then they the inspectors want to follow up to make sure that that the appropriate actions being taken, or they'll look at that data and then they'll start asking questions. Well, what about this trend? What about that trend? What are you doing about it? So if you don't have those systems buttoned up, then that can cause an inspection to go sideways very quickly, and can lead to threats into several other areas. So, you know, kind of ties back into what we were talking about in terms of continuous auditing and continuous remediation to really make sure those systems and processes are working, and try to identify where they're not and how to fix those.
Excellent.
Scott, just a quick question. Who do you normally have running the CAPA programs?
That's a good question. Depending on the end of, or depending on the company, sometimes the you know, people running CAPAs, sometimes it's almost a punishment, right? Okay, you've got to go do these CAPAs. But ideally, you really need to have your top engineers and your top quality people working on those CAPAs. CAPAs really kind of like complaints, they're also a gift, because they allow you to really go in and dissect issues, to really understand them. You want to make sure that you have a well-defined problem statement, because if your problem statement's not defined, then the rest of your activity is really not going to be that focused. So putting your top level engineers and quality personnel on CAPAs will enable you to be more effective in executing the CAPA, will provide greater visibility, because those individuals are also usually tied it back into the new product development activities, so that they can carry that information back into new product development. You know, the output of those activities become very visible to management, because there's usually some course of action that's taken, you know, those have costs associated with it, they have time associated with it, and so having your best people up ensures that you're really focused on the best, most efficient solutions, and a lot of times most cost-effective solutions as well.
Yes, in my previous experience, I met with the CAPA owner, and he said, "This guy just doesn't like me, so he gave me this CAPA." So I've heard that personally, and we don't want that to be the case. So if that's happening in your company, give us a call. We have to talk. That's not healthy. That's not healthy when it comes to culture. So we talked a good bit about, obviously, CAPAs and complaints. And Scott, you had mentioned before as well, having the feeders in your system, right? Having all of the mechanisms, looking at the trends, looking at the data, and bringing those feeders back in the system so the organization leadership can react. Stephen Needleman, I want to ask you, you know, what are some of the other big picture things that companies are missing?
Yeah, so I mean, Scott's presentation was spot on, the importance of trending data, staying on top of it, knowing where you stand, taking the appropriate actions, opening the cap is, don't think a cap is closed until it, the cap is not closed till you verify effectiveness. You need to make sure that a lot of firms think, well, we just got through, we didn't verify effectiveness yet, but you know, we'll get there. And then they don't verify effectiveness. Management reviews, they need to be conducted on a routine basis, on a regular schedule, whatever your schedule is that you've established. Firms that are in trouble should have those management reviews more frequently than annually or semi-annually. Executive responsibility, management with executive responsibility needs to be abreast of what's going on. The whole culture of quality is very important within FDA's thinking. You know, it's so much easier when it comes from the top down versus the bottom up. You know, with MedSAP inspections going on currently, FDA is not in firms as frequently as it has been, but certainly I know personally that they're focusing on firms that have class one recalls and multiple recalls across a firm's an entire firm's line. In other words, multiple sites that are having recalls. That's opening FDA's eyes to a culture problem and a potential problem. Even though they're not in doing inspections, those will prompt inspections by FDA. Supplier quality is an issue. Too often, you know, on 820.50 purchasing controls, there's not enough focus on your supplier. There are so many suppliers out there that have never ever been visited by a firm, by the manufacturer. And when they get a part from a supplier that's failing in a device, is that part also used in another device? And is it equally problematic or not? I mean, you need to look to your left and right when you have those situations. Scott raised risk management, going back and looking at that, looking at your complaint data, recognizing when you have a complaint. We have clients that have told us we've never received a complaint ever. And then you go back and look through their files and you say, what about this? What about that? Oh, that they were just commenting on the device. They were just commenting about their experience. They really didn't have a problem. And so, you know, you really need to know when there is a problem and be able to recognize it and take the appropriate action. There's no question about that. Just knowing about silent recalls, knowing when to take those actions. We just being aware of what the requirements are. You know, Scott, to the point about CAPAs and assigning CAPAs, and I've been at firms where literally they assign them as punishment. People have to be trained on CAPAs. How to do a CAPA. Training is another element that firms seem to fall down on. They don't teach them how to do a CAPA. They don't teach them about documentation, et cetera. So there's a whole variety of a whole basket full of stuff that industry needs to be aware of going forward to make sure that they are operating in a sense of compliance and that, you know, again, it's all about patient safety and patient risk. So we want to try to do whatever is necessary to reduce that.
I think what I'm hearing too, again, is that culture, and it's the culture from the top down and making people feel comfortable to take ownership that they see a problem, speak up, right? There should be no penalty. There should be no detriment to your career because you were the one that was the messenger, right? As an organization, what you would hope is that everyone understands the importance of patient safety, the importance of a high quality product on the market to maintain market share. And then you would hope that everyone would feel comfortable bringing concerns, bringing issues to the table when they see trends, when they hear from sales reps in the field. All of that information is important and helpful and allows us to have that culture that we need to have really healthy and safe products on the market. I completely agree. You can tell I like this topic a lot too. I wanted to keep the culture question going, because again, I really do want people listening today. We don't have a ton of questions. Please feel free, if you do have any questions, put them in the chat real quick. We're probably going to wrap up here in just a few minutes, but What are some take-home messages? If you're sitting in your desk today listening to this discussion, and you're wondering, how can I be an impetus for change? How can I be someone who can bring culture to the forefront within my organization? Are there any examples anyone on the panel can share, any suggestions for people that they can try to bring culture, communication, collaboration all to the top of the discussion? Who wants to start?
Well, the way I see it, I mean, for better or for worse, I've been involved throughout my consulting career since leaving FDA in assisting firms with significant enforcement actions and significant remediation activities. And it's important that what I see are the two biggest challenges for industry is changing that culture of quality, making sure they embrace it again from the top down. It's so hard to push it up. It's so hard for middle management to get their managers to understand the importance of quality and to take the appropriate steps. And then if you can achieve that culture of quality, it's the sustainability. It's not once you get there, you could say, phew, I can go back to what I was doing before. And this is really clear in firms that are under injunction or corporate-wide warning letters or warning letters. You know, everybody's rushing to get everything done and, you know, meet deadlines and assure compliance and get certifications or assure conformance and ready for that FDA inspection. But they have to be able to sustain it. And that's really critical. And that goes back to the original topic here is making sure those mock audits continue, making sure that somebody comes in and does that mock audit and start with, you know, a lot of people forget this, but your mock audit procedure should start with the security guard at the gate that sees an FDA investigator coming. And how do they react? And do you have call down menus? And are your IT people ready? Should a conference room needs to be cleared in case somebody shows up unexpectedly? You got to have all those procedures locked down. And you have to be ready for that. And the only way to do that is, you know, it's just like how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. And practice audits on a repeated basis.
Excellent. Anyone else, please? Anyone else want to add?
Certainly, yeah. Go ahead,
Richard.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you will become as no surprise as the first thing I would say is do your internal audits, do them often, do them regularly, you know, keep on doing them. And then when you're doing your internal audits, make sure you cover your entire scope. We see a number of times where the sites are doing rinse and repeat. They do this rinse and repeat process where they keep on going over. They don't cover the full scope. They don't cover the full site. They have the same people doing the audits over and over again. And after a while, it becomes just a cookie cutter process. You know, the idea of doing an internal audit is supposed to look at the risks and take a risk-based approach to your audits. And
there's a lot of benefit to have independent people do those internal audits as well. Because there's a lot of buddies in the firm and you don't want to tick somebody off. So, you know, I'll look the other way. Firms just need to be careful of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes we've seen where the internal audit is handed down to the most junior person in the room and they do find something, but they can't speak out loud. It's a cause of concern to senior management, but they are afraid to say so. So having a culture within the organization where people are prepared and able to speak truth to power is a critical one. Yeah. So and one of my colleagues who does audits on a regular basis, you know, when he does internal audits, he says, look, it's better for me to find it, better for me than a 483. That's his catchphrase.
We have a number of t-shirt logos coming out of this discussion today. Practice, practice, practice. We got complaints are a gift. All right, very good.
Yeah, to that point, it's interesting. Although I again, being involved with a lot of significant remediation activities where FDA has identified 15, 16 observations or whatever during the most recent inspection. And then one of the first questions I always ask, do you conduct internal audits and what did you find? We don't understand. We only found three things. Well, then your three things are not, your internal audits are not robust enough, because it's an opportunity for you to really keep your house in order and FDA not to find things. And if they do find things that they're, that you're already on top of, you're in great shape. So, you know, to the importance of those internal audits, they should be as robust and tough as any external auditor that comes in, whether it be from a foreign body or from an FDA regulatory body.
Absolutely. Always better to actually the organization noticing their issues and calling them out and documenting them, for sure. I think we actually wanted to launch a really quick poll for the group that are still with us. We're going ahead and launch a poll now. And then I believe this is going to wrap up our discussion for today. So a poll is active. I think if you click on the poll icon on your right, we have the question for you: from your experience or observation, what is the most significant barrier to creating a culture of quality in the med tech industry? Obviously, lack of leadership accountability leading the way. Oh, I like this real-time activity. This is fun. I don't think I'm personally surprised by the numbers we're seeing. And I think that's really what we've talked about today, right? Leadership accountability, culture coming from the top down. Not surprised. Keep those votes coming. So knowing that that's where that poll is going to land, likely lack of leadership accountability, what do we have as our final takeaway message for those joined us today? How can they help keep their leadership accountable? We'll assume that even leaders on the call today are ones that care about quality, that they're obviously educating themselves and joining discussions like this. But what can we tell the person who has a leader that maybe isn't as serious about quality? What can we offer to them besides looking for another job? There, I said it.
Yeah, one takeaway is really to be proactive. You know, convince your leadership that taking a proactive approach really helps reduce costs, helps reduce risk, helps reduce stress. And being proactive and always, if you can work toward being in a state of continuous inspection readiness, it'll really benefit your company, your products, your culture, because it becomes part of everyday activity. You're always looking for, you know, what may not be working properly or where can we have an improvement, rather than being in a state of just continuously reacting to problems and issues. So just taking a proactive approach can be very powerful in an organization, and driving that message up to your leadership will be very powerful for them as well.
The cost of quality is a lot cheaper than the cost of non-quality. When you look at recalls, regulatory actions, having consultants coming in and taking all the necessary steps to come back into compliance ultimately, because at the end of the day, that's what you're out to achieve. So the cost of staying compliant, doing these mock audits, staying abreast of everything is a lot less expensive. It continues to keep your product in the right limelight versus being subject to some type of an enforcement action that's going to cost you significantly more at the end.
Very good. I think that's where we're going to end the discussion today. Thank you so much. Stephen, back to you.
Thanks, everybody. We sincerely appreciate everyone being here today. Thank you to Stephen Needleman for joining us as a guest. Before I say anything further, I dropped a survey link in the chat just a little bit ago. It should only take you a minute or so to complete that. And by completing that, it really helps us to make these sessions better and help, you know, understand how we're doing. So thank you in advance to anyone who completes that. You will receive a comprehensive follow-up email from us tomorrow. It'll contain the recording, a summary of the questions that we covered, the presentation slides, and more. And you'll also receive an automated email only 30 minutes from now with just the recording. So if you're dying to revisit a specific part of the conversation or just one of the slides that was presented earlier, you won't have to wait too long for that. We have two upcoming events happening in April that you can find in the Knowledge Center at rqmplus.com that we just need to tell you about. The first is a webinar on April 16th, aligning your QMS with the FDA's QMSR updates. And the second is May's RQM Plus Live show, which will be a behind the scenes with BSI head of IVD notified body, Alex Lawn. So again, you can sign up for those in the Knowledge Center at rqmplus.com. And last thing is I always have to squeeze in at the end, please follow RQM Plus on LinkedIn. If you use it, you can easily find us by searching for RQM Plus. 3 weeks ago, we started publishing a free LinkedIn exclusive newsletter called the RQM Plus Weekly Watch. Essentially, we found we are conducting a ton of regulatory intelligence internally, which we've always done. And a good chunk of that was very suitable for external view. So now we're sharing that with everyone on a weekly basis. So that's it. Thanks once more for attending today and being here. We hope to see you at one of our April events. Bye, all.